I'm glad you could come. And, I was asked to talk, I guess, about something, not the weather, something else. So I thought, I don't know, are we missing a person? Or did she leave?
She left.
She left, okay. I don't know how long anybody has, you know, been meditating, so I figure I'd talk about basic stuff. Some basic stuff that it doesn't have an expiry date. It just, it's always applicable, no matter whether you're a beginner or you've been meditating for a long time and you're still a beginner, because the longer you meditate, the more beginner you get, as far as I'm concerned. So, I thought I would start by talking a little bit about boredom, how absolutely boring it can get on a cushion, and how sometimes, I don't know about you, but I get the feeling like it gets almost claustrophobic, like being in this constant stream of thoughts, whether they're gross thoughts or subtle thoughts or whatever thoughts. And thank goodness we have a technique that allows us to cut through that. Coming back to the breath, or if you're doing mantra, or whatever you're doing, we have techniques to tame our mind. And the boredom, I personally think, is very, very good companion in a way, because though in this society, we're constantly looking for entertainment. I think in traditional societies, it wasn't so much like that. But my my sense of this is that it has to do with the speed of the mind and the speed of change that we're experiencing in the world. So when that speed used to be slower, then you can just relax more, be less stressed. And that boredom becomes a sense of just, you give up. You give up trying to do anything about it. Trungpa Rinpoche used to have an acronym for this, CCL, and it meant, for those of us in the know, couldn't care less. Couldn't care less meant that no matter what thoughts came, you couldn't care less. If they were good thoughts or bad thoughts, or whatever. In terms of but he also used to tell us that this led to some sense of, like, after you've seen your storyline, you've heard your storyline so many times over and over and over. I mean, if you're a serious meditator and sit a lot, not just a little bit here or there, but if you sit a lot, it's almost revolting that your mind keeps, you know, just like broken record over and over and over and over and over again. And you sort of have this sense of revulsion, what he thought was fantastic. Because then that meant you were fed up with your samsaric existence and just, you know, gave up. And in terms of the teachings of Buddha, what this teaches is to go beyond the eight worldly concerns. You know about the eight worldly concerns? They're
Yeah, but I spent a while.
Four pairs of tools. Mm-hmm. Four pairs. There's you go beyond pleasure and pain. You go beyond praise and blame, beyond fame and dishonor, and beyond gain and loss. And I would like to add, beyond hope and fear. So you just, maybe for the first time in your life, just give up about any sense of second-guessing or judgmental anything. You are just sitting, your mind is active, because that's what the mind does if you're not dead, and you just row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. It finally dawns on you that that's what you're doing. And I find that the gaps that occur when sitting in meditation are also as valuable as the stream of thought, because the gaps are there if one sits long enough and lets go enough. And we realize that, contrary to what we usually perceive, there are gaps between thoughts. They are not just all continuous. So that is quite a realization, to just experience gap. It cannot be transmitted. One has to actually experience it. So what is happening in the gap? It's just space. One actually experiences space, but there is a presence, or there is a knowingness, or a consciousness, or whatever you want to call it. It's not just silence. Because the knowing quality of the mind is there. So that presence, without all the baggage, is very conducive to the realization of egolessness. Or to being awake, just completely, fully present, awake, with the five senses functioning. And it also, I guess, this, when we feel less burdened by all the baggage that we saw and let go of, saw and let go of, saw and let go of, we're less preoccupied and more relaxed. I guess there's no other word for it. More content, more present. The present part is just so. And one of the realizations one tends to have in that state is the uniqueness of every moment. And the uniqueness of the meditator that is being present. Like, there's not two of us alike, there's not two moments that are the same. As Heraclitus say, you can't step on the same river twice. So this realization brings a sense of completeness, wholeness, and aloneness, because we are very unique and distinct. Though we all share, you know, we're all sentient beings, we all breathe, the makeup of our mind are essentially all the same, the five skandhas, but we are each who we are, which is quite alone in a deep sense. This has nothing to do with loneliness, by the way. This is just, it's actually the opposite of loneliness, because aloneness actually gets you closer. The conundrum is, because you realize how alone each of us is, one gets closer with others. I don't know how else to describe it. Because that is the human condition. It's not just my condition as a meditator. That is the human condition. And in a sense, all the time we spend watching our film go by and letting go of it has given us a very profound knowledge of who we are. Even our darkest corners or our most blatant caricatures of ourselves, you know, we can laugh at who we are, we can cry with who we are. And this leads us to care more for ourselves and care for others. The friendliness quality of knowing who we are and the full acceptance of that by letting go of it, not holding on to it, but by it just being so. This gives birth to what has been called unconditional confidence, meaning this is not a confidence that what a good meditator I am, or you know how many languages I speak, or how good it is I am at my job, or I'm confident I can. It's just unconditional. It's not confidence in anything, because one is fully who one is. I would say with this realization, if one can live moment by moment like this, what the texts call ta-ta-ta or suchness becomes your reality. And there is no escaping from this. There is, like, just like there is no way that our eyes get tired of seeing, or our tongue tired of speaking, or we just function that way. And when we function that way, funny things happen with our heart. With our sense of being present also has a sense of being tender. very, very open and vast. And our heart feels like empty and sad at the same time. Sad in a poetic, almost, kind of way. Like if you hear a sonata, or if you see a beautiful sunrise or sunset, or something like very strikingly beautiful that just stops your mind. And that open, vast, warm heart is what we call the genuine heart of sadness. And this open heart is very, very accessible all the time. And it just cannot but help others. It is helping us first of all, because it's making us genuine warriors. But whatever's needed, it prompts us to do. It's what in Buddhist terms we call compassion, karuna. It's the selfless, skillful action that is always helpful in any situation. With emphasis on helpless, selfless, because there is no sense of I am doing this. It's just being done. So that was what I thought I would toss out here in this circle. It actually has a threefold logic. It goes from boredom to aloneness to tender sadness. For you who know the ground, path, and fruition approach of threefold logic, are you familiar? Oh, it's a way of proceeding in thinking. So you have a premise that is the ground, and then you have a path, some kind of process, and it achieves some kind of goal, the fruition. So the ground, path, and fruition, you get to where you're going. So this, the ground is boredom, the path is aloneness, and the fruition is tender sadness. This, I was reading something by the Sakyong the other evening, and he was talking about connecting with Drala, and he said you need confidence to do that, otherwise they don't manifest. And in order to develop genuine confidence, one has to be willing to be bored, alone, and sad, is the quote which got me thinking about this talk, that it would be a nice thing to discuss.
In my own life and practice, between the kind of aloneness that the Sakyong is talking about and egotistical aloneness. I think it's egotistical anyway. Sometimes I feel like I'm the only one out there doing this. This is especially when I'm in charge of something. And so I feel very alone. But it's all based on the fact that it's all based on ego clinging. But when I can give that up and think about and be present with aloneness, the way the Sakyam is talking about it, it's a completely different feeling. And as you were saying, it's kind of a connection with others. Whereas the kind of aloneness I usually feel is kind of based on anger, really, and fear.
Do you know why that is?
Well, I don't, probably. I feel like it's because I'm trying, instead of following the path, I'm trying to do it the way I think it should be done. And it just doesn't work.
But you know, the path also has discernment.
Mm-hmm.
Things, you know, to accept things, to reject.
Mm-hmm.
So we never give that up, even though we're non-judgmental. We do know the difference between good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And in the relative world, there are consequences of doing good things and doing bad things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's at the relative level, that's what happens. So, from the little I have known you, I would say that you are forever doing things for others. And at times you probably would like to be helped doing that. But if nobody's helping you, you go ahead and you do them yourself. That's why you got the volunteer award. The Shambhala Day. Because you're always doing something that needs to be done. You probably
are
telling
me. I think needs to be done.
Well, there you are. I mean, it does. The tea needs to be set. You know, a person is sick and needs to be helped. And you do those things. I wouldn't be too hard on myself about that.
Right. I mean, I feel that the things that I am doing presently are pretty grounded. I think they have a good purpose, as opposed to just making me feel better about myself.
Right.
But I still get this, what can I call it? Maybe I won't call it aloneness, maybe. Except that's how I feel. I feel, oh, I'm all alone. Boo-hoo, poor me. And then, of course, hopefully I practice and I'm together with my friends and the other people who are involved, and I realize that was just me having an ego tantrum, and really I'm part of a larger picture and part of a bigger group. It's not just me by myself. And yet, on the other hand, I know what you were talking about. We are all alone in that more pure sense, I guess I could say.
Yeah, so you could say there's an absolute and a relative.
Mm-hmm.
About anything, so about mm-hmm. this as well. There is the absolute aloneness of
mm-hmm.
just the human condition
mm-hmm.
that we all experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then, depending on what's going on in each individual's life, there is the relative aloneness.
Right. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Well, I kind of struggle with helping and then pulling back and knowing knowing my limitations with some stuff, you know? Because my history has been just giving, 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 and then I burn out. So I have a lot of fear around.
Mm-hmm.
I guess trusting myself to know that's it. I can't do anymore, you know, for whatever reasons. I have a capacity, and maybe I can do more than I think, but for whatever reasons in that moment, I don't want to do anymore, you know. So I don't know. I don't know how that fits with, you know, all of this, but... you know, isn't it okay to have limitations with stuff? And
well, we all do.
You know, and actually acknowledge that and be okay with that instead of... Because I think there just seems like so much confusion in this culture about helping and what that's supposed to look like and feel like and why you're doing it and... I don't know.
Well, I would say from the Buddhist perspective, what is most important is one's motivation. So if you're truly motivated to help, rather than, let's say, I'm not just talking about you anymore, self-aggrandizement or reward or fame or whatever, if you just truly engage in helping whatever situation it be, and you do it to the best of your ability, then that's that.
That seems clear, but hasn't been my experience of it. It's just the endless need.
Yeah.
That the people that I'm with have an endless... It's like there's no filling of the well. There's just no filling of the well.
Well, there isn't. You're right. You're very right.
So maybe, you know, what I'm trying to do is absolutely impossible, and it's not like I'm with other people who are actually trying to do the same thing, and it's...
Well, there is such a thing as idiot compassion, the Vidyara called it. And that is... you know, like what is called an addiction, I think it's called...
codependence.
Yeah.
Enabling.
Yeah. Enabling. Yeah. So there is that.
Yeah.
But if it isn't that extreme, then one does whatever needs to be done. And there is this manner in which to do things that it's called the triple purity. Which is actually what, you know, that white scarf around the Buddha, the katas, signify. Why are they white? It's this purity thing. There is no giver, no receiver, and no action. Life is but a dream. We're back to that. So that's why it's pure. And that's why it's... a transcendent act in terms of the Bodhisattva path. Because there is no self there. Now, in the case in which one is in a situation where demands are being placed that exceeds one's capacity, you know, like you use the word burnout, I heard you say, you know, if that is leading to burnout, you have to use, again, I'm going to use the same word, you have to be discerning between what's helpful and what isn't. And we usually tend to think, in Buddhism and in Shambhalian terms, the benefit of all. All includes oneself.
So.
The benefit of all is all. And oftentimes, we just think of our own benefit or of others' benefit. But it's the benefit of all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've had a situation where you have experienced burnout as a result of whatever you did by giving too much or doing too much or saying too much or something, then obviously you're weary of that.
And wary of it too, you know?
Yeah. That's logical. So just watch that, how that, the dynamic of that, you know, what's going on with you. But whatever it is, there's just please don't be judgmental.
Mm.
You know, we haven't talked about humor, but humor goes through the whole ground path and fruition part. Because, I mean, when you really are bored, it's just so funny. So absolutely hilarious when just the broken record goes over and over and over again. I mean, all you have to do is go to the long month meditation programs we have, and at times the whole shrine room, I mean, 20, 30, 40 people are just laughing their heads off. Because it gets just so completely funny. And the aloneness part is also very interesting in terms of humor, don't you think? Because we live in a pretty tight-knit society, so we're actually very seldom alone for very long, yet we are so alone. We're born alone, we die alone, and in between, we are alone, no matter how close we are with whoever we are. Nobody's experiencing the same thing I'm experiencing right now but me. Nobody. So, and of course the fruition of the tender sadness is also very funny. I find it hilarious. And I'm just wondering what went through the Vidyara's mind when he gave it the term sadness. Because it is very sad, but it's also very light, you know, like in terms of, we usually tend to think of sad as this heavy thing. I don't know about you, but sad has a heavy connotation. This is not that. This is very light. Poetic sadness, whatever you want to call it, is that romantic longing for who knows what? What do we go through life longing for?
Sadness.
Tenderness, I think. It's the tender longing for just being whole. And being whole with others who are whole.
Yeah. I mean, there is something worse than being sad, and that is to be just sort of dead. Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't feel anything. So I think
right. When
you have that open heart, it's unbearable, but it's also so much better than it was when you were just cowering in your hole trying to avoid it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That
would
be quite pleasant.
Yeah, but it gets kind of sweaty.
Yeah. Well, everybody loves the smell of their own armpit.
Yeah.
You know, that it's that kind of thing.
You know, what you said about aloneness, I don't feel that way at all. I do not feel alone at all. I don't feel like I was born alone. My mother was there. There was a doctor there. You know, I just don't feel...
We're not talking about that.
Oh, okay.
Of course your mama was there. You didn't materialize out of thin air.
Yeah.
And the doctor or whoever, however your birth took place. We're not talking about that.
Okay.
We're talking about an existential...
Yeah, even on that level, I don't feel alone. I don't know, maybe I'm not a Buddhist.
I feel
I kind of
this is not a Buddhist thing.
Connected, like We're not alone, really.
Oh, yes, we are all connected.
We're all floating around in soul groups, and then we go up and we see them on the other side, and we drift back and forth. And,
yeah. We are. You are so right. We are all connected. We're connected in our beingness.
Yeah.
But we're also very unique.
Okay.
You are who you are. There's no other you out there in the universe at this moment.
But isn't the human experience fairly... it's pretty much the same for all of us, isn't it?
Exactly. That's what I said. Well, I use a technical term. I said the five skandhas.
Okay.
The five skandhas are a Buddhist way of describing the mind, the five aggregates or the five skandhas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makeup is... in every single being. There's no doubt about that. And that we're all connected, no doubt whatsoever. We certainly are all connected. But each one of us is an individual.
Yeah.
That's what the aloneness means. The existential sense of your own individuality. And when you're born, that comes into being. Even in your mother's womb, that's into being. There's nobody else unless you have a twin in your mother's womb. There's nobody else in your grave. That's what I mean. That individual sense of who you are. And you are just so accepting that fully. Non-judgmental at all.
Well, one theme that I've kind of heard here tonight is several of us are struggling with people in need and how to balance that. And I think there's a lot of need in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've heard this, you know, if you look in the world at homeless people and homeless dogs, people will always pick up a homeless dog. But they won't pick up a homeless person because the homeless dog is so much easier. People are so complicated. They're so exhausting. and I think it's exhausting. I'm glad I'm not the only one struggling with these things. I frequently tell my husband now, please don't ever let me help anybody again. Because I am so tired of this treadmill. You know, I mean, I am so ready to just go walk dogs and not deal with people. And that's sad. I feel badly about that.
Are you doing this for a living?
No. I actually, I just have a couple really needy friends that are lovely people that I adore. But I just, it's just this constant, you know, thing. You know, where it's like I'm always providing, and I should just do it lovingly, you know, but I get resentful. And, you know, this one woman, I know, you know, she's 70 and she's a bit of a shut-in because of her health, and I know that she, when I see her call me, I was like, oh yeah, now I remember I was supposed to order the cat scratches. It's like there's always a task for me, and when I go visit her, the whole time she's tasking me. So
she really needs help.
I know.
But you might just talk with her about this.
Well, you know, what is there to say? I mean, she needs these things done.
Right.
I'm not the
but
only
there's
person
more
she's
no.
Asking.
No, we had a situation like that. A friend of ours who was a meditator had left Boulder and came back at the same time that I came back from Canada, and she had cancer. You know, and all of us, her friends, wanted to help her. And we did. She was this amazing sunshine woman. But there was a limit to how much each one of us could do, and we sat down and we discussed it all with her and her daughter. And so if you feel like that, maybe this friend of yours also needs other friends.
Well, she does. Or I mean, other, she has other
providers.
Little workers, you know.
Right, which she does.
She has
so she's reaching.
Helpers.
Yeah, she yeah. needs the help. So she needs helpful. The help.
Yes, yeah, she does. Yeah.
She did, and you have to sort of like say, well, I can help you, you know, so many hours yeah. per week, or I can.
Well, that's what, I mean, that's what happens, but it's just, you know, I've noticed that because I'm so busy helping her, I'm doing less of the volunteer job that led me to meet her. So I'm actually not doing the volunteer job very much anymore at all. I'm just helping.
She's become that. She's become
yeah.
your sole
yeah.
volunteer.
And that's kind of sad. But, you know, whatever. I mean, I just didn't. It's nice. I guess I'm not happy to hear that other people struggle with that. But I also feel less alone in that situation. But that's just
yeah.
kind of,
but that
so
that is the nature of a good life.
Yeah, absolutely.
A good life, my definition of it, if you were to ask me, would be one that is in harmony. Harmony means balance. You know, there's a time for everything. And it's in harmony. So what you give and what you take, they have to be in harmony. I think harmony is a not often used concept. But I think for me, at least in my life, it's, you know, like how much time I spend in conceptual thought, as opposed to how much time I'm just not in conceptual thought. There has to be a harmony in my life about that. A harmony in living with others in a harmonious way. So, I don't. So it's not just about only in terms of helping others or not. It's way more than that.
I've been reading this really interesting book called How to Be Sick by Toni Bernhard. How to Be Sick. Uh-huh. Mm. And she has a chronic disease. She's been chronically ill for many years. And that's what this book is about, is how she's learning to cope with the situation.
Mm.
And I feel like some of the people that I've helped in the past have kind of, how could I say it? It's like they've let their needs become themselves in a way, and they're not working on being whole people. I don't know, it sounds so corny, but I don't know how to explain it better. And that's what she's talking about in this book.
But you have to have a sense, Carol, of having experienced your wholeness before you lost it. Because it would be very difficult if you didn't have some kind of inner work or inner sense of, I'm not just my lower back pain.
Yes.
I'm not just my sickness.
Yes.
I'm not being defined by just what's wrong or right about you, but that you could transcend that. If you haven't got that sense before it hit you, it would be very difficult to get it.
Well, what she finds and what she tells about in the book is that when this illness has gone on and they've tried all these cures and nothing's worked, she felt that she had lost that sense, and how she worked on gaining it back.
To regain it. Good for her. Because,
And it seems that then the helping, because I think where the confusion might be is not seeing the person as whole. That that's actually not helping them. Gee, this person is really needy, you know, whatever we attack, you know, and then it's like, well, I've got to help, you know, I've got to help, this person's suffering, I've got to do something. And
And that's not really helping them.
No, I mean,
because if you see them as whole, they start experiencing themselves as whole.
Yeah.
Because we are all reflecting off each other all the time. All the time. So if you see a person as whole, not just their needs, and treat them like that and address them like that, it helps them too. That's, in a way, the best help.
And for them to see the caregiver as whole too, and not just this
providing.
Yeah, right.
Person whom you have more than another.
Yeah.
And that you have more, a better relationship, more complete relationship, not just.
Right.
Does this person, have you finished the book?
Yes. Yeah, it's really interesting.
So does this person, because sometimes when you go through a lot of things that are, you know, trauma and various things in your life, they always think, I want to be like my old self. It's often they become something even larger than that.
Yes, and that's part of the process, is that she's given up this whole thing about regret. And now, she hasn't completely given it up, of course, but that part of the process is that she gives up this kind of living in mourning for the way she used to be, and this anger and this
grief,
yes. Yeah. And finally, she says, the book is about how she comes to have a good life in spite of this, and including this.
Yeah, because she's letting go of negative emotions.
Well, so, I mean, this is very important, I think. She's letting go of her fixed, rigid ideas about how it must be in order to be good.
And this is also for
people who are giving help. Like you were talking about, like, if you go into it with a sense that, well, for this to be successful, I must cross off the list all the 17 things that this person needed.
And if
that doesn't work out, then I have failed.
Yeah.
You know, and it's more nuanced than that, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
It's not, helping that person doesn't consist of doing this, that, and the other thing. It's more about presence and...
Totally.
And
it's always about that.
Yeah.
No matter whether that person is having a time of their lives or really deep suffering, it's always about being present together.
So all of us that are caregivers, how does meditation fit into this? I'm just asking a rhetorical question.
Well, what do you mean, all of us who are caregivers?
Well, you talk about caregiving, I'm a caregiver, you're caregiving, she's caregiving. I'm sure you are. So, what are the advantages of meditation to help us deal with
I see the question. The advantages of meditation are that, first of all, you would see clearly what the needs are. Because not always the boy's needs are the best ones. So you would see without filtering too much. Just like you can... It gives... Meditation gives a certain direct perception ability. A certain clarity to go beyond filters by direct perception. And as you shed more and more of your conceptuals, how should it be, you see more directly. It's just the gradual process that happens. And you're also, I would say, have more energy. Because the mind is resting in meditation. That's again the harmony part. You have to have enough harmony in your life that you have a busy mind, but you also have a rested mind. And a rested mind has more energy to offer because it's not all the time.
And it also can discern. So the discernment is this too much for me right now? Yeah. I need to stop.
Yeah, right, you know, exactly. It's like when to rest and when to be active. So
that's good. You know, I can't do anymore. That's all right, you know.
Yeah. So it helps in those ways. And, well, I'll stop there.
Well, and I found that it's really helped me to know myself so much better, so that it seems like that gradually over the years meditation, I'm gradually being more and more, the word I keep coming back to is real. Instead of having this facade that I'm presenting.
Genuine is the word we usually add.
Yeah, and Eric and I both took the nonviolent communication class and then the self-empathy class, and Trudy and I took the focusing class, and I found that all of those things coming together with meditation, that they're so related.
Yeah.
And that it's showing me, helping me realize and experience all aspects of who I am, and that this is making me a better caregiver. It's not just this.
Well, it's making you obviously a better person.
Yeah, yeah.
A more wholesome.
Yeah.
I don't know about better.
Yeah, yeah.
More wholesome.
Yeah.
And person. More genuine who you are.
And maybe, I don't know if this is your experience, but maybe you don't stew in your... Maybe you don't stew in your juices as much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can kind of go, oh, you know, you get into your thing, your little habitual thing. And then you go, oh, you know. Yeah, I kind of go, oh, no, you know. Or I'll say to myself, I have to do that. Or something, you know, where I can just go, I don't really want to, like, get into that. There's something about being able to sort of let stuff go. I see it coming. I see it present itself.
That's a whole
I know
purpose.
It because I've been doing it for a really long time. And then I go, oh, okay. Because I don't really want to do that right now.
I think that's
the
whole purpose of meditation. The whole process of touching and letting go. Touching and letting go. And I hope I die like that. That at the moment of death, I'll be able to just let go of this life. Like, nothing's holding me back. I've lived this life fully. I just do the same thing I've been doing gazillions of times over and over again and just, boop, let go.
I so appreciate you saying, you know, about the sense of humor, because that's exactly the spot that you had 10,000 times. Here it comes again.
He's like,
yes.
But there's a you know, a friendliness towards it too.
Yeah.
It's like,
smile. There's a very friendly smile at our fears. At who we are. According to the instructions I'm following, at 8:55, we should
stop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Stop and
make an
announcement. Are there any announcements?
Yes. I'm going to just flip the folder.
Do you remember when I'm...